the years-long conflict triggered by foreign-backed militancy. The pledge was made by President Raisi as he made a speech at the Holy Shrine of Hazrat Zainab, the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad. Raisi also lashed out at the U.S. and Israel for backing terror groups in Syria.
For 12 years, the oppressed people hatched conspiracies and committed sedition, gave easy money to Daesh and Takfiri terrorist groups, used media empires to conduct psychological warfare, inflicted damage, destroyed homes, killed children, and made women homeless. For 12 years, the U.S., Israel, and the Takfiri Daesh terrorist groups they backed committed crimes in Syria. But Syria is standing strong today.
Combating terrorism is another issue Iran and Syria put focus on in their joint statement. They've pledged to continue to work together to fight terrorism and extremism until all terror groups are completely wiped out. The statement also denounces the U.S. military presence in Syria as well as its looting of the country's natural resources. It demands the international community to bring an end to the U.S. measures. The Iranian-Syrian statement also denounces Western sanctions imposed on both nations. Meanwhile, it slammed the Israeli regime for its repeated acts of aggression against Syria, saying that Damascus has the right to respond to Tel Aviv's aggression. The statement said that the Israeli aggression is a destabilizing factor in West Asia. Iran has said President Raisi's visit to Syria is in line with efforts to reinforce the axis of resistance in West Asia, including in the occupied territories, Lebanon, and Syria itself. This should be seen against the backdrop of Israel's weakening position in the region, as the regime is gripped by turmoil inside and facing mounting resistance outside. Iran and Syria are both under Western economic sanctions. The restrictive measures, however, seem to be a blessing in disguise for both nations as they're resolute in overcoming economic hurdles by forming stronger bonds and relying on their own potentialities.
On Thursday, about 6,000 employees from the Italian phone carrier Wind Tre walked out of work in protest against the management's decision to spin off the firm's network assets into a separate company. Wind Tre is the third largest Italian mobile operator with about 20 million customers and the second largest fixed line operator with almost 3 million subscribers. The industrial action had been called by Italy's three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and UIL, against the unbundling deal, which unions and workers say is the prelude to mass layoffs.
We have to stand united against this spin-off. Breaking up companies always leads to detrimental consequences for workers. The best case scenario is that we get further stripped of working rights. The worst is thousands of layoffs.
The spin-off of telecoms operator Wind Tre will pave the way for the sale of a majority stake in the grid company to Swedish private equity firm EQT. Unionists say Wind Tre will shift some 2,000 workers out of a total 6,500 workers in Italy into the network venture.
Sta cambiando il modello industriale.
The industrial system as a whole is shifting towards a new paradigm in the communication sector, which features separating the management of the network grid from that of services. This way, Italy will further lose control on its strategic assets, and many smaller companies will kick in, exacerbating job insecurity in the country.
Job insecurity is rampant in Italy. According to statistical agency Eurostat's figures, Italy has the second lowest employment rate for young workers in Europe at about 30%. Also, Italy has no minimum wage but protects workers through collective agreements, which often remains a dead letter for people on precarious contracts. Meanwhile, Italy's government has scrapped an anti-poverty benefit that goes under the name of citizen income, replacing it with a more limited inclusion check for qualifying households starting from January 2024. Prime Minister Meloni argues that the citizen income, which helped about 4 million people last year, costs too much and discourages people, especially youths, from looking for jobs.
Personally, I have been forever looking for a dignifying job, but the only things I'm offered are badly paid long-hour jobs. The citizen income should have been amended, but not scrapped altogether.
Nearly half of workers aged between 30 and 34 in Italy have an income between 8,000 and 16,000 euro a year, an income bracket that ranges from absolute poverty to near subsistence. An increasing number of Italians are leaving the country in search of better opportunities abroad. Max Civili, Rome.
Not only in the stories, some are among us and remind us of the fact that chivalry is not dead yet. Hamid Reza Aldari is one of them. The Iranian nation is mourning his death after he was brutally stabbed in the back and chest while defending two girls against a number of knife-wielding thugs in one of the streets of the northeastern city of Sabzavar. He later succumbed to his wounds in the hospital. Thousands of people from different walks of life took part in his funeral, hailing him as the martyr of courage and a brave national hero. His wife says he acted based on his zeal for defending the oppressed.
This could have happened anywhere else. My husband defended an oppressed person and fought until the last breath. This is the ultimate bravery.
To get a better understanding of the social aspect of this incident, I talked to a sociologist who noted that Martyr Aldari's brave act should be venerated by the people.
Here you see a citizen who acts based on his social responsibility as he observes a crime being committed. He has social commitment. This is very valuable, especially at a time when the global trend is individualism and people are after their own interests. Now a member of the society has stood up to defend another person and identifies with her. We must recognize this brave act and introduce this person as a role model to the society.
While a CCTV video showing the moment of Aldari's stabbing has gone viral, some anti-Iran media have tried to use it to attack the Islamic Republic's values. To get a better understanding of this, I asked Mr. Asghari about their intention.
Another aspect of this incident is that in social media you observe a rather different approach toward this brave act. Some media outlets follow frameworks that do not support Iran's national interests. The martyrdom of Hamid Reza Aldaghi has once again unified Iranian society. However, we see anti-Iran media try to use every incident to polarize the society, cause enmity among people, and increase anger in the society.
Acts of sheer courage by the Iranian nation that are based on moral and social responsibility have foiled anti-Iran media campaigns. Hamid Reza Aldaghi's martyrdom is a case in point that proves Iranians are always ready to give their lives to safeguard their values. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi arrived in Damascus on Wednesday leading a high-ranking delegation. The president then headed to the presidential palace where he was received by his Syrian counterpart Bashar al-Assad with an official welcoming ceremony. The two officials held talks in which Assad underlined the importance and depth of relations with the Islamic Republic. He noted that both countries share visions based on respecting mutual interests and the two countries' sovereignty. Assad thanked Iran for its mediation efforts in Syria-Turkey peace talks and expressed support for Iran's right to peaceful nuclear energy. Raisi, for his part, congratulated Assad on Syria's victory in the war on his country, hailing resistance as an effective tool for free people of the world. He stressed relations between Syria and Iran were never affected by regional or international developments, reiterating his country's support for the people and government of Syria.
We discussed different topics as well as means of boosting our bilateral relations. We are determined to develop and expand our ties with regional states without a presence of foreigners, as they only cause instability. We should get rid of U.S. forces in our region. Securing Syria's sovereignty necessitates the withdrawal of U.S. troops.
The two presidents signed a long-term strategic comprehensive cooperation agreement. Ministers of both countries also signed a number of memorandums of understanding in the fields of oil, agriculture, rail, and aerial transportation, free trade zones, earthquake reliefs, communications and information technologies.
Agreements today, as well as projects discussed, will push forward our relations through mechanisms that will increase the bulk of trade exchange and investments. This would reduce the impact of economic sanctions, especially at a time when world economic balance is shifting eastwards, and this would liberate world economies from Western hegemonies.
Assad also welcomed the restoration of diplomatic ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Officials are also set to discuss the establishment of a joint bank and insurance entity that would facilitate trade. The visit further consolidates the already historic and strong ties between Iran and Syria. It clearly launches a new phase of economic partnership following a successful military and political collaboration that set an example in the region in fighting terror and foiling U.S. and Western plots. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
It was his sixth hunger strike and the longest, which lasted for 87 consecutive days. Palestinian prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan stubbornly resisted until his last breath, asking for his release he always obtained after every hunger strike against his illegal administrative detention by the Israeli authorities. This time, however, his hunger strike ended with his martyrdom in a cold cell in the Israeli prison of Ramli at dawn on Tuesday. Here in his hometown, Arabi, near the occupied Jenin, his wife spoke to the crowd who gathered outside their home to consolidate the family and his nine children. They called for his revenge and also for all Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails.
I congratulate myself and my children for the martyrdom of Sheikh Khadr. Now, after his death and all the sacrifices he made, we do not want a drop of his blood to be spilled. We will not wait for anyone to avenge my husband. His nine children will keep his cause alive. And to the Israeli occupation, I say, remember the faces of my children well. By God, we have raised them with pride and dignity.
A general strike has been announced across the occupied West Bank in mourning for Sheikh Khadr Adnan. Protests have been held in several areas, including Ramallah. Palestinian resistance groups have mourned what they described as the execution of the senior leader of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, Khadr Adnan. They say they hold the Israeli occupying regime fully responsible for Adnan's murder. Since 2004, Adnan had gone on six hunger strikes, drawing local and international attention. Not only did he become a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, but also a symbol for the cause of Palestinian prisoners.
The Israeli regime has sent a clear message to the whole world that we will continue killing Palestinians even after their imprisonment. Today, Sheikh Khadr Adnan has set a new level full of pride in the history of Palestinian prisoner movement. After his assassination, the Palestinian people are facing a new stage of struggle. Today, we all must unite and stand against the practices of the Israeli regime for the sake of our prisoners.
All Palestine is sad for the martyrdom of the hero prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan. It was not his first hunger strike. Every time he was courageously declaring a hunger strike to reject the illegal administrative detention that the occupation's regime uses to keep thousands of our people behind bars. Unfortunately, this time his strike came to an end with his martyrdom.
Meanwhile, several protests have been held in the occupied Ramallah in response to the Israeli murder of Sheikh Khadr Adnan. The demonstrations turned violent in a number of areas, namely the cities of Arram, Al-Khalil, and Ramallah, with clashes erupting between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian protesters. Israeli forces fired at the crowds and a number of Palestinians were wounded. The Day of Rage will always be remembered as a day of honor and loyalty to Sheikh Khadr Adnan, who is considered by many here as a national hero. Every time Sheikh Khadr Adnan engaged in a hunger strike, he insisted that he will not end his action without achieving victory. His definition of victory was either getting released or being martyred. This time, he achieved victory by martyrdom. Palestinians also believe he was an iconic figure who succeeded in bringing another defeat to the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Monlay.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. All human blood may be red from a physiological perspective, but in the United Kingdom, blue blood rules. The coronation of King Charles III is living proof of that, as it took place on Saturday with much pomp and circumstances and a £250 million price tag for the British public. In a country where the quality of life continues to deteriorate for the average Brit, it becomes more obvious that the pomp is for a privileged few and pressure for the majority. Well, I'd like to talk about all of this on this Spotlight. Welcome my guests to the program. Lyndon Opick, former member of British Parliament, out of London. And Nick Napier, activist and commentator out of Edinburgh. Thank you both for being with us. Well, actually, you're in Seattle, I guess. So, okay, I saw something else up there. You're in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
What does it mean, Limbit, to have a hereditary monarchy in the 21st century?
First of all, apologies for very poor sound. I couldn't make my normal hands-free work. In terms of your question, it means that a majority of people in the United Kingdom still do seem to support the monarchy, but the monarchy has to justify itself economically now. As you said in your introduction, Britain is a poor country. Relatively speaking now, it has huge economic problems. And the hundreds of millions that this coronation has cost really needs to be repaid, at least in terms of tourism by the royal family. But more than that, my biggest concern is that the government doesn't understand the contradiction. I don't really blame King Charles for the stupid economic decisions made by prime ministers. King Charles wasn't elected. He's a hereditary head of state. But the politicians should at least have explained why it's okay to spend this enormous amount on the monarchy rather than simply trying to suppress opposition. I think it's legitimate, regardless of my own views, legitimate to be a Republican, but you shouldn't have to justify yourself or get arrested for having taken that position. So fundamentally, it's the politicians rather than the royalty that I blame for the pressures that you rightly outlined in your introduction.
Okay. Well, Mick, your perspective and your belief system in dealing with this hereditary monarchy in this 21st century, when it's a country that always lectures others about equality, human rights. I mean, your overall assessment, Mick.
Well, I agree with the great British political revolutionary of a couple of hundred years ago, who was very influential in America and France, Tom Paine, who said it was as ludicrous to have a hereditary head of state as to have a hereditary carpenter or plumber, or he would say today, IT technician. It makes no sense, but it makes sense in one way. If we look at the three three elements of the British state. The House of Commons is elected. The second chamber is unelected. And the monarchy, of course, by definition, is unelected. So there are large parts of the state which are not open to the will of the people. And although the demonstrations in London today and elsewhere, I haven't kept up with them, were quite modest, it's difficult to tell what percentage of the population sympathises with them. I mean, when I was younger, it used to be in every cinema, in a time when cinemas were the main method of public entertainment, that people were expected to stand at the end of the evening's performance for the national anthem. Well, because nobody stood but rushed for the exits, that particular institution was retired because there was no support for it. It's difficult to know what the support for the monarchy is in any real sense. You can measure numbers, and older people tend to be much more conservative and much more pro-monarchy. Among young people, it's a very different story. Mm-hmm. And the last numbers I read were that 40% of people under the age of 25 preferred a monarchy and something very similar preferred a republic and something very similar for those under 35. So it's difficult to measure. It's also difficult to measure because although a fellow guest says it's not illegal to be a Republican, it's certainly disparaged in the mainstream media. We learned a few days ago that the BBC, in its meticulous and expensive publicly financed preparation to cover the coronation, actually puts its footage to the palace first of all for its agreement. So in a very real sense, the chunk of the population who are Republican in sympathy, or the equally large proportion who don't care and don't support the monarchy, okay, their views are filtered out.
Well, Limbitt, pro-royalists, when answering critics, say that the Queen, or now the King, is mostly a ceremonial role. How can that be said when technically he can appoint and dismiss ministers and even declare war?
Good question. And it's down to the behaviour of the royal family. Now, I won't give you a history lesson in British monarchy, but hundreds of years ago, one member of the royal family, one king, ended up in huge trouble for trying to push Parliament around. Different politicians and different monarchs get on to different degrees. And the big question isn't so much the constitutional position, because as you've just heard, it is theoretically a ceremonial position. It's the extent to which the monarchy seeks to influence Parliament. But here it gets complicated. With a good political system, with a good Prime Minister, with a good Parliament, everything's beautiful. It works well. The monarchy perhaps is a nice adornment, a nice, beautiful thing to look at, something that brings tourists to the UK. But if the government is weak, the monarchy becomes more powerful. And that's what ironically provokes republicanism and makes it harder for the monarchy to justify itself. But that's because the elected politicians aren't doing their job. I actually think that's the situation we're in now.
Well, Mick, with rising food prices, rents, and much pressure on the National Health Service, NHS, do you think the average British citizen benefits from the presence of the monarchy in general?
It's very patchy. I just saw the much-hyped call to come together in the main square of Glasgow, my native city, to celebrate the monarchy and even to take a vow of allegiance. And the square was empty. There was a huge big screen available for anyone who wanted to participate, but people had voted with their feet or actually by not using their feet. So given that today we have millions of people relying on food banks, that most people have a very genuine sense that the much-loved National Health Service, one of the gems of British culture, is in danger and is being whittled away government after government. The fact that when, you know, people who are now in the internet economy actually delivering goods around the country earn such low wages that they have to drive dangerously in order to make a living. And, you know, my daughter lives in Berlin and lives quite well in terms of the being young, but being able to rent a house where the rent controls are very, very significant. Young people in Britain are finding it impossible to live, certainly to buy a property, but to pay rent, which doesn't reduce them to dire straits. So life is hard, and in that situation, the monarchy is an institution of the state, and the views of millions and millions of people intersect in the person of that monarch. Some support it, some despise it, but at the moment there's a widespread sense among the experts, and in fact John Curtis from Strathclyde University is widely seen as the leading pollster in the country. He's saying that there's still a majority for the monarchy, but really it needs support, because the support is ebbing away, especially among young people.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, Limbit, in a country where basic staples have skyrocketed and 1 in 10 kids are facing poverty, and even working people such as teachers, where 1 in 5 are experiencing food poverty, in general, why would so much money be spent for the royal family? And a lot of it, especially if what we saw today, again, being funded by the working class. It just seems, where's the equity in all of this?
Well, there is no equity in it. The difference between the richest 5% and the poorest 5% in the United Kingdom is horrendous. In many ways, we're like a third world economy, where if you've got it, you can get richer. If you haven't got it, you can't even afford to pay your rent, as my colleague has just said. But there's a different question to ask here. Does the royal family do more good than harm? Now, I have to say that in terms of the opinion polls, my personal view is that most people in politics in Britain do still feel that the monarchy is relevant and they want it. One of the ironies is that oftentimes the Queen was preferred as the person to run the country more than the Prime Minister. And then I move to my second and perhaps the central point here. The lack of equity isn't because the royal family have made stupid mistakes in government policy. It's because the government has made stupid mistakes in government policy. If the UK really was a superbly wealthy country, then actually the royal family, even if it was making a slight loss, is an affordable luxury. I suspect the royal family does make quite a lot of money in terms of economic turnover. But fundamentally, the problem is the argument has not been made satisfactorily by politicians. And what I think we now see is a potentially popular King Charles III and a potentially extremely unpopular political situation, where the Labour Party and the Conservatives, the two main parties, simply aren't talking to the country. And here's the biggest irony. Imagine if I'm right. Imagine if King Charles III becomes a more attractive leader of this country than the people that we elect. So, yes, it's expensive, but it's far more expensive to the UK if the public preferred the unelected royalty than the elected government.
Well, it's interesting what you said, Limpet, because it already appears that Charles doesn't have a whole lot of charisma. I mean, because when talking or looking at people's statements, our correspondents on the ground there were positive said, more positive said about the Queen, of course, in her 70-year reign, and there was a bit of a reassurance perhaps given by her. And she stayed, for the most part, tried to stay out of controversial domestic matters, whereas Charles, even as prince, was not so successful. So it doesn't seem that he's going to have a whole lot of charisma during his reign. I mean, your take. Go ahead.
I've been lucky to meet him a few times. Actually, at a personal level, I have to tell you, I've just got to tell you the truth. He is charismatic.
Okay.
He's likable. He's quite charming, and he's very funny. But he's also quite political. The Queen, especially on things like the environment, the Queen was careful not to be quoted in public. Sometimes she was, and that caused anger to the royal family and to the advisers. But she had 70 years to build her popularity. King Charles has only had one, and let's remember that the royal family under the Queen about 20, 30 years ago was really unpopular when Princess Diana died in that terrible car crash in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest problem for King Charles is he is not the master of his own destiny. How the public feel about the interrelationship between the head of state and the head of government, that's a really big factor. Can King Charles be as popular as the Queen? Maybe, but he won't have 70 years to do it. I watch with interest what he does. I want him to do well. The Queen did, I think, very well in her role. King Charles didn't choose to be born into the royal family, and he has got a duty of care for what his responsibilities are. Maybe others say that we will become a republic. I don't think that's going to happen soon. And therefore, if I was King Charles, the next time I met the Prime Minister, I would say, you've got to do a good job so that I don't get the rep for your bad behavior, because I can't come into the Commons, knock on the door and take over, even if I'd like to.
Right. Well, he didn't choose to be a king or part of the royal family, but, you know, £250 million worth personal fortune of £1.8 billion. It's not a bad position to be in for him, I'm sure. Well, Mick, overall, I mean, we've talked about the stark contrast between the older and younger Brits and the existence of the monarchy in general. And today, with the coronation taking place, there were protests and chants of "Not my king." Do you see the role of the royal crown diminishing in the future, or your overall assessment?
Well, we have to define what the role of the monarchy is, and I think it's overwhelmingly symbolic. It's a symbol of grotesque privilege, lording it over great poverty and great lack of security. I mean, there is a political element here of real power. There was I can't remember the year, but an Australian government was dismissed by the Queen's representative, the government, the Governor General, and she dismissed a left-wing government and opened up the road for a right-wing government to replace it. And Australians remember this very, very well. So although the powers are residual, they remain real in periods of crisis. Lembit mentioned the situation when Princess Diana died. It wasn't a political crisis, but it was a profound crisis for the royal family. They trembled in their palace because a spasm of powerful emotion went round the country, which measured Princess Diana very favourably against the rest of them. And that crisis it's essentially a corporation, the royal family. But that crisis inside the people who managed that corporation was very profound and very real. And they managed to ride the wave of rage and anger, but it might have been quite a close-run thing. But the main thing about the monarch is it symbolises privilege. It symbolises inherited wealth. It symbolises the domination of people who may lack any quality, any redeeming quality, but who solely by virtue of the bed into which they are born becomes head of state or become a group of royals who have a huge, huge silver spoon in their mouth. So it's that grotesque endorsement of inequality which I think rankles with millions of British people today. Difficult to tell how it will take shape, how the Republican movement will develop, but I think John Curtis is right. Although there remains a majority for as measured by pollsters, the foundations look increasingly shaky, and unless there's action taken to strengthen them, then I think the future looks challenging for the House of Windsor.
Okay. Well, I'd love to continue this conversation, but unfortunately we got a little started a little late because of some technical issues. I appreciate both of you being with me. Lembit Opik, former member of the British Parliament out of London, and Mick Napier, activist and commentator out of Edinburgh. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
In the limelight.
Chinese officials have always warned the United States about selling weapons to Taiwan. Chinese experts are saying America is trying to make instrumental use of Taiwan to contain China, but that these actions are very dangerous. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. China Daily has covered this story and tells us more. Beijing says Washington should halt arms sales to Taiwan since the U.S. is turning the island into a powder keg. China's foreign ministry spokesperson Mao Ning made the remark with reference to a Taiwan-U.S. defense industry forum held in Taipei on Wednesday, 3rd of May, where a delegation of U.S. arms dealers called for deeper cooperation between Washington and Taipei. The spokesperson said, lately, the U.S. and the Taiwan authorities have been stepping up military collusion, adding, it is further proof that the United States is turning Taiwan into a powder keg, which only spells trouble for our Taiwan compatriots. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said, U.S. arms sales to the Taiwan region seriously violates the One China Principle and the three China-U.S. joint communiques. Mao Ning added, China firmly opposes them. Mao Ning warned any external forces meddling in Taiwanese affairs may have to pay for their actions. She said, the Chinese side will take strong and resolute measures to firmly defend our sovereignty and our security interests. Any external forces that interfere in China's domestic affairs and undermine peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait shall bear the consequences and pay for their actions. Beijing regards the island as part of its own territory under the One China Principle. In recent months, tensions between China and the United States have been rising over Washington's growing military and political support for Taiwan. China often conducts military exercises around the island as a warning to Taiwan's separatist forces and their collusion with the United States. Bloomberg News Agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Taiwan is reportedly in the process of buying 400 land-launched Harpoon anti-ship missiles from the United States, in a move that is expected to draw condemnation from China, which considers the self-rule island part of its own territory. Citing U.S.-Taiwan Business Council President Rupert Hammond Chambers and sources, the U.S. Daily reported recently that Taiwan was poised to purchase 400 missiles under a $1.17 billion contract announced by the Pentagon on 7th of April. At the time, the Pentagon said production was expected to complete by March 2029. Commenting on the news report, Taiwanese Defense Ministry spokesperson Sun Li Fang said, the ministry had previously disclosed information about the purchase, adding it was confident the deal would go according to schedule. In 2020, Taipei said it planned to obtain land-based Boeing-made Harpoon anti-ship missiles as part of its military modernization program. According to Bloomberg News Agency, Taiwan previously purchased a ship-launched version of Harpoon missiles, but the new contract marks the first time it will get the mobile land-based variant of the missile. Bloomberg cited U.S.-Taiwan Business Council President Rupert Hammond Chambers as saying the contract with Boeing was issued by the U.S. Naval Air Systems Command on Taiwan's behalf. Beijing views Chinese Taipei as an inseparable part of China, reportedly warning Washington against unwise provocations. China has previously warned Washington that providing the self-rule island with advanced weaponry would breach Chinese sovereignty and do severe damage to bilateral ties. The report comes just days after U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen in California and stressed the need to accelerate arms deliveries to the self-rule island. The website of Press TV has also covered this story and tells us more. Tensions between Washington and Beijing are now entering a rather dangerous phase. China has launched military drills around Taiwan in what it called a stern warning to the self-rule island. The United Sharp Sword, the three-day military exercises sent planes, ships and personnel into the maritime areas and airspace up the Taiwan Strait off the northern and southern coasts of the island of Taiwan. At the outset, the Chinese military said the type of weaponry China will use during these military exercises would include long-range rocket artillery, naval destroyers, missile boats, air force fighters and bombers. The military exercises were to include live fire drills off the coast of China's Fujian province, which faces Taiwan. The exercises follow a provocative meeting held in the U.S. state of California between Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen and the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy. China, which regards self-rule Taiwan as part of its own territory, was enraged by this visit. Beijing has vowed to eventually take Taiwan over, by force if necessary. The military exercises by China came as a delegation of U.S. legislators, led by Chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee, Michael McCaul, was visiting Taiwan and met with Taiwanese leader Tsai Ing-wen. Michael McCaul claimed the delegation was in Taipei to show its support for the democratic island. Speaking at an event in Taiwan, Michael McCaul underlined that the visit was intended to demonstrate strong support for self-rule Taiwan. McCaul's trip to Taiwan was not the first such visit by a senior U.S. official to the self-rule island. Last August, then-U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, along with a delegation of Democratic Party members of the House, to reaffirm Washington's support for Taiwan. Apart from Nancy Pelosi, some of the other high-ranking U.S. officials have, on numerous occasions, shown Washington's all-out support for Taiwan, including U.S. President Joe Biden. President Biden has given the strongest warning to Beijing, reiterating Washington's commitment to defending Taiwan's military in the event of an attack by China. Beijing has reiterated its sovereignty over the island, saying no individual force can hold China back from achieving the goal of national reunification. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Mao Ning said Beijing is firmly opposed to any form of official interaction between the United States and Taiwan. But what if China tries to reclaim Taiwan? In such a scenario, would the United States and its allies be able to prevent this from happening? While Beijing asserts that the self-rule island is an inseparable part of Chinese territory and that the future of Taiwan lies in reunification with the motherland, what objective is the United States seeking other than provocation? The pertinent question should be whether the United States would stay quiet and take no action if China were to station its forces and fleet around Central and Latin America or anywhere near U.S. borders. Undoubtedly, the security of Taiwan has the potential to be used as a political tool by the United States and NATO against Beijing. But a more dangerous scenario is one in which Taiwan could be used as a reason for conflict between the West and China, much like what is currently happening in Ukraine between the West and Russia.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz,
and in southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.